Lamar Walden is a historian and the author of Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK, and joins us on the program this morning. Good morning, Lamar.
Great to be speaking with you.
Can we start with JFK's childhood? Did he have a happy childhood?
Well, he had a very wealthy childhood, which means his parents were distant in some ways, and he had a very large family as well. So, you know, compared to other people growing up in the Great Depression, yeah, he had a happy childhood. But, you know, there were issues that he had to deal with.
What were those issues?
Well, he had a lot of health problems. You know, he looked very healthy. You know, I was a young boy when he was president, you know, and he looked with the picture of health. He was handsome and everything, but he had numerous health problems as an adult and when he was younger as well. So he really wasn't as healthy as he looked. He was not the oldest son. He had an older brother who seemed to be destined for everything great. You know, John Kennedy was, you know, was kind of the younger brother. He was kind of skinny, a little on the gawky side, a little more intellectual, whereas the older brother was, you know, bigger and stronger, and some people used to say at that time more handsome. You know, so he was kind of growing up in his brother's shadow, and that wasn't easy. And it was a big family, so you had to fight for attention anyway. His father was famous, you could say almost notorious in the 30s. He had been a big stock manipulator in the 20s when that was legal, and had some high-profile affairs, and you know, was an establishment wealthy. He was the outsider wealthy, super wealthy kind of guy. So, like I say, JFK, you know, it was not a typical childhood by any means.
What was his education like? Did he go to the best schools, and was he a good student?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, Harvard, that sort of thing, yeah. So he was, you know, exceptionally bright, you know, smarter, I think, than his older brother. So that was where he chose to excel, and his father was the ambassador from the United States to Great Britain in the late 1930s. So he wrote this book, While England Slept, and you know, so he had a good sense of foreign policy even then. You know, and then he joins World War II, you know, into the Navy. He had an interesting experience that kind of would affect his presidency. We all know Pearl Harbor, right?
Hmm.
Well, JFK, when he joined the Navy, he was first stationed at Naval Intelligence Headquarters in Washington, D.C., and there were a lot of reports coming in about the Japanese fleet. And the United States essentially lost about half of the Japanese fleet that was really active in the Pacific. Well, you know, that was not a good thing, right? So, of course, that was the part of the fleet that attacked Pearl Harbor. Well, on the Sunday, it was Sunday in America when Pearl Harbor was attacked, you know, they were all called back in immediately and told to destroy lots of files about what had happened.
Hmm.
And then JFK was sent, all the people in that division who knew what had happened were sent hither and yon all over the United States so that, you know, investigators from Congress or from President Roosevelt could never find out what had happened.
Where did his interest in politics start to develop after the war, and was his father heavily influential in that with diplomacy?
I think so. Well, his older brother died during World War II.
Okay.
So that changed, you know, so Jack was looking at growing up the intellectual, and I think he had looked at politics, but I think his brother was more destined for politics while he was alive, at least from the father's perspective. You know, one of America's richest men, you can do a lot for your son in politics. But, you know, when the son died, then it was John Kennedy's turn, and that's when he, you know, that mantle fell on him. And he, you know, and he was a war hero, and that's what kind of, for that post-war generation, that was one thing it took to start a career in politics. You know, if you were a veteran and you had fought, that was a good thing. And so that's what helped launch him, as well as his big family. You know, they would go out and campaign for him, as well as his father's immense wealth, too.
Was he pushed into politics by his father?
You know, again, I don't know if you'd say pushed into politics. His father certainly encouraged it, but it was something he was very interested in. Yeah, you know, he was very interested in. You know, so again, I think it's something he kind of grew into as well. In other words, once he got started, then I think he realized how much he enjoyed it as well.
How old was he when we started to see him move into politics?
Well, you've got me there because I don't have my notes in front of me, but he was always, you know, rather young for somebody in Washington. In other words, he was young as a member of Congress. He was young as a senator, and then he really, in terms of the year he became known, and again, he's definitely young for a senator. He started going after the mafia and the mafia's ally Jimmy Hoffa starting around 1957. And, there were rumors his father had mafia connections, but then most wealthy people and many big companies did in those days. So perhaps JFK went after the mafia to deal with, you know, those rumors. But someone had to go after the mafia because the mafia could do anything they wanted to in America in the 1950s under President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon. And the mob could do whatever they wanted to in Cuba, all these American mobsters. So nobody was really, the administration we had, the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, they weren't going after the mafia at all. So someone needed to do it, and he's the guy who stepped up, and people often forget that's what propelled him to the presidency. He was going after the mafia and then going after Jimmy Hoffa. But unlike so many candidates for office, and I'm sure in every country, JFK actually kept his word. And he waged a huge war against the mafia after he was elected. He appointed his brother attorney general, the highest, law enforcement guy in the land. And they went after the mafia very, very hard.
Hoffa's also involved in unions, and there's this whole push for unionism. Was that sort of counter going against his people's sort of persona, Kennedy?
Well, of course, JFK was a Democrat, and the Democrats mainly got the union vote. Hoffa and the man who led the Teamsters Union before Hoffa, Dave Beck, were very corrupt and very tied in with the mafia. So they would often sell out their members, for money, and they would do a lot of deals with the mafia. In fact, much of Las Vegas was built with funds from the Teamster Pension Fund, that was loaned to the mafia at very low rates. So Vice President Richard Nixon, who was an anti-union candidate and vice president, he wanted some mafia support in the 1960 election when he was running against JFK. So Hoffa had been exposed by the Kennedys, and it was looking like Hoffa might have to get indicted because the Kennedys had exposed how corrupt he was. So a deal was struck, and Vice President Nixon was given $1 million by several members of the mafia who were big, beneficiaries of Jimmy Hoffa. And in return, Nixon got money he needed for his campaign. He got the Teamsters to endorse him. And in return, JFK stalled the indictment against Jimmy Hoffa while he was vice president. And then Nixon got one other thing, too. Those same mobsters who gave Nixon the $1 million bribe, Nixon had the CIA hire those mobsters to kill Fidel Castro, the Cuban leader, right before the 1960 election. Because Senator John F. Kennedy was young. He was in his 30s at that time. And whereas Nixon had been vice president for 8 years. So Nixon thought if Castro were killed and U.S. troops had to go into Cuba to protect U.S. interests, the population would vote for Nixon, right? The experienced guy. JFK had no real foreign policy experience. He'd gone after the mafia. That was his experience. So Nixon, like I say, he ordered the CIA to hire the mafia to kill Fidel Castro. That did not happen. The mafia tried to kill Fidel, couldn't do it because they didn't want to be blamed for it. The mafia knew if they killed Fidel Castro with machine guns, like a mob killing, the Cuban people would never let their casinos in Cuba reopen, right? So the mob was too careful in what they tried to do. They tried to poison him. didn't happen, but unfortunately for President Kennedy, who was elected, the CIA kept working with these same mobsters without telling President Kennedy or Attorney General Robert Kennedy. And that would come back to haunt JFK in 1963, because by 1963, the very same mobsters that John and Robert Kennedy were prosecuting, the godfather of Texas, who controls organized crime in Dallas and Louisiana and New Orleans, a guy by the name of Carlos Marcello, and the godfather of Tampa, Santo Trafficante, and the mafia don for the Chicago Mafia in Las Vegas and Hollywood, a guy named Johnny Roselli. The Kennedys were going after those three mob families in particular, all while the CIA was working with those mob families to try to kill Fidel Castro without telling the president. And well, so what the mafia had to do, though, because they were going to be all sent to prison, the Kennedys were getting ready to go in and clean the mafia out of Las Vegas. So what the CIA did for 1 year, they planned to kill President Kennedy. They very, very carefully planned that. And they used their work for the CIA to cover their real goal, that was to kill President Kennedy. So, you know, there was a high CIA official named Richard Helms who thought the mafia was helping him to try to kill Castro. In reality, you know, all the weapons and the sharpshooters and everything else, you know, and involving Jack Ruby, the nightclub owner, that was all not to kill Fidel Castro. That was all to kill John F. Kennedy. And so you can see why the CIA has had to cover up so much for so many years, because of that unauthorized operation they were running.
We'll bounce backwards and forwards, taking a look at the story of Kennedy as we're moving towards the assassination. John, good morning.
Look, the thing that is missed with Kennedy, in my opinion, is the fact that he kept America out of major wars for his entire presidency, as had Eisenhower. And he and Eisenhower had one thing in common. Both of them had experienced war and knew how terrible it was and how little there was to gain for those activities. As soon as Kennedy was killed, the war in Vietnam escalated till they had more than 500,000 troops in America, in Vietnam. And you'll find all the presidents that make these ridiculous wars, like George Bush, Nixon, and Johnson, are people that never really participated in wars. So this is a great contribution he made. He kept America out of a major World War III over the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he warned the American people that a major war, such as anticipated by the generals and so forth, would result in the death of hundreds of millions of people. And he reminded American people that Russians, Chinese were the same as Americans. They both had mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and families. And I think that was the greatest contribution he and Eisenhower did, and that was to keep America out of major wars.
John, just let me go back to Lamo. Lamo, just a comment.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we all here in America benefited from John F. Kennedy, because there were actually about three times when he prevented major wars, and one of those times probably prevented World War III. It wasn't widely known, but in the first few months of Kennedy's administration, there was the failed invasion of Cuba by the CIA-backed Cuban exiles that failed, and JFK had said he would not use military forces to help those exiles. But, you know, the CIA tried to trick him in doing it. He wouldn't be tricked. But it's now known that the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, had said if JFK had used regular U.S. military forces against Cuba, he would have attacked U.S. forces in Berlin. And then later on in 1961, there was another confrontation over Berlin. Cooler heads prevailed. And then, of course, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, all of his generals and many of the other officials wanted to invade Cuba at that time. And so cooler heads prevailed. But it is interesting. This is in my newest book, which is The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.com, is JFK was getting ready to take some very risky action against Cuba. in late 1963 because he did not want Cuba to be a big factor in the 1964 election, because the Republicans who were going to run against him, it wasn't known at that time which one it would be. It could have been Nixon, could have been Goldwater, who eventually was. They were all lobbying for that we still needed to invade Cuba. And JFK did not want to trigger World War III by doing that. So he tried a couple of different peaceful outreaches to Fidel Castro, secret, hoping he could reach some negotiated settlement. But if those didn't work, on December 1st, 1963, JFK was ready to back the head of the Cuban army, who was going to overthrow Fidel Castro, and then invite U.S. forces into Cuba to prevent a Soviet takeover. Now, that would have been a very dangerous and risky operation, and President Kennedy hoped he could avoid that with a secret negotiated peaceful settlement. But time was running out, and when JFK died, he was only two or three days away from having to make that decision of whether to go the secret peace route or to, you know, complete the coup plan with the head of the Cuban army, who, by the way, remained unexposed and in power for decades, which is yet another reason so much had to be kept secret about the JFK assassination, not to protect JFK's killers, but to protect the number three man in Cuba who had secretly been working with John F. Kennedy. So JFK did keep us out of wars, no doubt, but he was in an interesting situation when he died.
Hmm. Mary, good morning.
I just wanted to say that I kind of feel like the Kennedys were a breath of fresh air in terms of, you know, they were an attractive couple. They had two small children. Jackie had lost a child. And they were kind of like American royalty, and Australians have been fascinated by royalty for as long as I can remember. And I think that Jackie, you know, she had such a sense of style and grace, and, you know, John was handsome. They had two gorgeous kids, and I think people just thought they were young and, you know, something different. And I also think that it was the age of television, so, you know, we were able to see images. And I mean, I was only a child, but I was five when he was killed. But I just remember my mother weeping and weeping and weeping, sitting in front of the television, just weeping. So,
Mary, I'll go back to Lima, because it's an interesting point that the whole mystique, the love of the Kennedys and Kennedy, was it because of policy, or was it the whole big picture, Lima?
Well, it's the whole big picture, and your caller is exactly right, that they are as close to American royalty as we have ever had and probably ever will have, and they were incredibly glamorous. And, you know, we were coming out of the, you know, very conservative sort of drab 1950s, and, you know, we were getting into the 60s, and here was glamour and fashion, and they brought, you know, classical music and high fashion, Oleg Cassini and all of, and then Jackie Kennedy was a very prominent first lady. Eleanor Roosevelt had been prominent, but in a totally different way. You know, Jackie was glamorous. She was very smart. She was talented artistically. She was very literate, very well-read, very witty. You know, so they were, it was like a Hollywood, if Hollywood had cast a president and first lady, you know, you could not have cast that better than JFK and Jackie. You know, and then when you add, I mean, JFK, when you watch his old press conferences, and we used to watch them in my family, you know, all the kids and the mother and dad, we would all sit around, and he would give these press conferences. And, you know, I'm sure he would have some scripted remarks, but he would make these just off-the-cuff remarks to these newsmen, this live primetime television, and he would just be great.
Does that mean that he got away with things that other presidents may not have, in as far as extramarital affairs and all of that sort of business?
Well, I think that's by a matter of degree. In other words, when you have, you know, many incredibly wealthy men have affairs, men who aren't incredibly wealthy have affairs. Men who are incredibly wealthy tend to have a lot more affairs and mistresses. When you're incredibly handsome as well, when you're the most powerful man in the world, you've got opportunities even a lot of your fellow wealthy friends don't have. So it was really a matter of degree, because when you look back at a lot of other presidents, they had their own share, but just not nearly in the quantity he had, and I have to say in quality as well.
But that doesn't make it right, and for a very for a society that that frowns upon those sorts of issues, it's still amazing that that he was considered to be okay.
Well, again, what you have to remember, and I just read another great article about that this week. It's in a U.S. site called Politico.com, and it talks about a political fixer named Bobby Baker. And Baker was an assistant for Vice President Lyndon Johnson, and he just makes it very, very clear that was the like I say, it was pretty much the norm that politicians had affairs and stuff. JFK did not do the drunken carousing a lot of politicians did. He didn't force himself on women like a lot of politicians did. So you have to look at it in context. It doesn't excuse it whatsoever. I mean, that was a personal failing that he had, but I think we don't want to let that overshadow, his policy accomplishments, what he did for the country, how he kept us out of the war, as your earlier caller mentioned.
We'll come back to that in a second. Chris, good morning.
I was wondering if your author might be able to comment on Lyndon Johnson's mistress's allegations and the integrity of those allegations regarding Lyndon Johnson's knowledge of the assassination the night before and the meeting that he was allegedly involved in, and also Lee Harvey Oswald's mistress, who is giving interviews currently on the internet, and her allegations that Lee Harvey Oswald was at the time of the mind that he was a Marine and he was working for the government, and he felt that he was being set up to be a fall guy.
Can you just sum those things up very quickly, Lamer?
Sure. Lyndon Johnson, Vice President Lyndon Johnson, certainly had his mistresses too, which is kind of what I was saying before. But the allegations of one of his main mistresses, Madeleine Brown, about Johnson knowing about the shooting and everything, that most experts and historians do not take her credibly at all. Yes, she was JFK's mistress. She may have even had a child by, Lyndon Johnson's mistress, may even had a child by him. But her comments, they just lack any credibility. The same thing goes for Lee Harvey Oswald's supposed girlfriend. She definitely, worked at a place where Oswald worked. But when you look for any evidence, any solid evidence, again, most historians and researchers and journalists do not take the so-called Oswald mistress credibly at all either.
Kennedy's involvement in civil rights and that movement at the time, because it was an incredibly big thing that was happening throughout the states in civil rights, how much of a forerunner was he and how influential was he with civil rights?
Well, as I learned when I did my last book, which was The Hidden History of Watergate, it turns out civil rights was very important to JFK, because in that 1960 election, in America, black voters had usually voted Republican, going back to Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, who freed the slaves. So, Lincoln was a Republican, he freed the slaves, so just out of force of habit, most African Americans had voted for Republicans. And, there had been, times Eleanor Roosevelt had really done a major outreach to African Americans. But like I say, most African American leaders and most of the votes went to Republicans. Excuse me. Well, in 1960, I'm actually talking to you from Atlanta right now. In 1960 in Atlanta, we had Dr. Martin Luther King. He had been arrested on some trumped up charge and was going to be sent to a very, very bad prison in South Georgia. We used to have these things called chain gangs, and they had sort of outlawed those, but what black inmates had to put up with was terrible, and many of them died. So Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King's widow called the Vice President Nixon, and said, can't you do something? Even if you can't stop it, can you bring publicity to it? Because they won't kill him if you come out and say that, you know, or they may not even send him to that prison if you'll, you know. And so, but Vice President Nixon was courting a lot of conservative voters, especially his biggest supporters who were giving him a lot of money, and he did not want to anger them by coming out, by saying anything about King. So then Coretta Scott King called John and Robert Kennedy and said, can you help my husband? And even though at that time many conservatives who were very anti-civil rights were Democrats, especially in the South, JFK felt like that was the right thing to do. So he came out very publicly to say, you know, King shouldn't be harmed. He shouldn't be sent, you know, to that horrible prison. And then he had his brother Bobby Kennedy call up the judge in the case. And this was probably wasn't entirely legal, but, you know, basically lobby that judge to change that sentence. And the judge did. And so suddenly the black vote went for the first time, really, overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidate, John F. Kennedy. And there have been rumors, you may have heard them yourself or your listeners, that somehow the mafia gave JFK the 1960 election. Again, as I document in this new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, that's simply not true, because the city the mafia was in, Chicago, is the most heavily Democratic city in the entire country. JFK had the richest man in America as his father. The most powerful political boss in America was the mayor of Chicago, who was a big Kennedy supporter. So the mafia claimed after the election they had delivered Chicago for JFK, but political scientists have analyzed all the vote totals, and that simply wasn't the case, because the mafia, they really, really wanted Vice President Nixon to be president, because he had been their man since the start of his career, and they'd given him $1 million, not JFK.
You're listening to Overnights on ABC Radio. My guest this morning is Lamar Walden, historian and author. We're taking a look at the life of JFK. John joins us. Good morning, John.
This is a bit left field, Trevor. I've got a number of American silver dollars among my coin jumble, if you call it.
Yeah.
And I have two silver dollars with John F. Kennedy on them. One of them, in the bottom on his neck, is embossed a hammer and sickle. And I'm wondering whether Lamar can sort of authenticate it or know a little bit about it.
Lamar, do you know anything about that?
Well, what we used to hear, so the symbol that some people used to think was a hammer and sickle were actually the initials of the designer. And it's actually the half-dollar coin. It's not the dollar coin. It's the half-dollar coin. And it was Gilroy Roberts, and he had a stylized G and an R that Kennedy's opponents said was, or the Republicans said was a hammer and sickle. Now, I've also heard that there were people that would actually then put a real hammer and sickle on some of those half-dollars. But like I say, if you look at just a regular one, you know, it's really a stylized G and an R for Gilroy Roberts, who designed the half dollar, which is still in use today, and it's one of the more beautiful American coins, because most of our coins actually don't look very good.
We're about 7 minutes away from the news. I'll try and get as many calls in as possible. I guess one of the great legacies that Kennedy was associated with was space travel. And how important was that to him, and why was it so important?
Well, because the Soviets beat us into space, first off. And so, you know, America, we had so many more resources, and we thought we had better education. And then the Russians beat us into space. And plus, they realized the military applications. We had more atomic weapons, more hydrogen bombs. But if you could rain down bombs from space, that would not be a good thing. And so it was both for a military reason and also for a, you know, national pride. In other words, if we can't catch up to the Soviets, you know, in the space race, what does that say about American ingenuity, education, et cetera? So, you know, that was an example of a very positive challenge. And to JFK's credit, he didn't, you know, militarize the space program. You know, once it got going, you know, he kept it a civilian thing, and he envisioned a lot of what came later, you know, multi multinational space probes and, of course, getting to the moon. And that was his goal, was to get to the moon.
How important was that relationship with Bobby Kennedy?
Was JFK's relationship with Bobby Kennedy? They were as close as any two brothers could be. It was incredibly close. Ted Kennedy was a senator, but you know, he didn't have the close relationship with either man that JFK and Bobby had, because they worked incredibly closely together. And John F. Kennedy, for instance, on Cuba policy, after the failed Bay of Pigs, JFK basically told Bobby Kennedy, "You handle Cuba for me. I'll trust you to do that." And that continued right up until JFK's death. That was a bit of a problem, because sometimes JFK trusted Bobby with too much. So Bobby Kennedy was the top law enforcement man in America, so he had the usual attorney general functions. He had this huge extra war against the mafia America had never fought before. He had civil rights. America had never done that before. And then JFK also gave him Cuba to deal with, even though he was attorney general, not the Secretary of State. And unfortunately, to get all of those tasks accomplished, Bobby Kennedy had separate groups for each of those things, the mafia, Cuba, and civil rights. And he didn't realize that, you know, for instance, the mobsters, the CIA was secretly using against Cuba without telling JFK or Bobby, were actually the same mobsters, you know, his mafia prosecutors were prosecuting, which then gave them the motivation to kill JFK, to end Bobby's prosecution of them. And, you know, they used those Cuban operations to do that with. And they were pretty much all very much anti-civil rights as well. There were a couple of white supremacists involved. And, of course, they hated JFK because what he and Bobby were doing with civil rights. So it is very sad when you look, you know, JFK very much died because of what he believed in and what he was trying to do to make America better.
John joins us. Hello, John.
G'day, Trevor. I know it's a bit short of time. I guess there's one point is an amazing team family effort, I guess, of their ideals, one. Two, watching TV programs and the particular close-quarter brutal end to Robert's life in a tally room, I think it was. And the other major point that I'd like to for comment for Lemur is the similarities between that little group of effort from the Kennedys and Obama, who is now and the future.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mention Obama, because one of the things that Kennedy was also strong on working on was education policy, and also a need for better health care in America as well on a domestic front, Lamar.
Oh, definitely. And Obama very much fulfills the legacy of JFK. I mean, Caroline Kennedy just explicitly said that. And, of course, she's now the ambassador to Japan. So, yeah, I mean, Obama is as close as we've come since JFK to having a glamorous, charismatic president who seems to, you know, really care about, you know, common people the way that JFK did. I mean, Bill Clinton came very close, but Obama just has, you know, he has more charisma than Bill Clinton had. And so, you know, I'm in the South here in speaking to you from Atlanta, but, you know, even in the South, I have to say Obama is very popular in many, many places, which I'm glad to see, because, of course, the South has had problems with civil rights over the past. So we all have a lot of hopes on Obama. I do have to say, when Obama was first elected, he was subject to more assassination attempts than any president since JFK. Because there were so many people that didn't like Obama and what he stood for.
We've got a minute and a half to go, but the big question that we've got here from Martin says, we've all heard about the assassination. Why was he killed? Can you sum it up in a minute and a half?
Sure. He was killed because he was going after organized crime. He had their backs against the wall. They had no place left to turn. And like I said, those very mobsters he was going after, they had an in on the CIA side of things to let them cover their tracks in a way that has really generated secrecy that lasts even today. In fact, I just started a White House petition last week to try to get all of the JFK assassination files released. But what's new in the book is now we have America's top godfather in 1963 actually confessed to exactly how he killed JFK once he was in prison in 1985. He didn't know he was sharing his prison cell with an FBI informant and that the FBI was recording many of his remarks. So there's just incredible detail we have now that pretty much explains every question anyone would ever have about JFK's murder.
Lamar, it's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you very much for your time.
Trevor, the same with you, and I've appreciated all the calls. Thank you so much.
Lamar Walden, historian and author of Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK, and also The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.